Andrea, proud supporter of WGTD's morning show. And in this portion of the Friday morning show, I am delighted to be speaking with a Disney fan and journalist by the name of Bruce Steele, who has helped put together a marvelous new book called One Day at Disney, Meet the People Who Make the Magic Across the Globe. This is a book in which we, in a sense, experience Disney all around the globe through the course of essentially a single day. And we're going to be talking with Bruce Steele for the next few minutes about what it took to assemble all of this wonderful information, all of these marvelous photographs, and what people are going to experience themselves if they take this book in hand. Again, the book is titled One Day at Disney, Meet the People Who Make the Magic Across the Globe. Bruce Steele, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thanks for having me. Good to be here.
So tell us, first of all, a little bit about what is behind those words, Disney fan. What has been your relationship to the world of Disney over the years?
Well, I mean, I grew up as a Disney fan, watching all the Disney movies. I remember being so happy when I'm old enough to remember when VHS tapes first came out, and then you could get your favorite Disney movies and watch them over and over again. And then in the 1990s, my husband was actually a Disney animator. So we had that magic silver pass that lets you go down to the theme park anytime you want and take guests. We lived in Los Angeles, and so we could go down to Disneyland and Anaheim as many times as we wanted. So I can't tell you how many times I've been there.
I wonder what particular projects your husband worked on. I mean, would these be things that we have seen, or was he an animator in a sense in more behind-the-scenes fashion?
No, he worked for 4 years on a Disney animation feature called Dinosaur that came out in the year 2000.
Very good. You know, your account reminds me of very close family members that I have who are at Disney all the time. I mean, repeatedly, year after year after year, they absolutely love it. And they aren't growing tired of it. And I think some people from the outside looking in would imagine that at some point the spell begins to wear off. And yet, at least for some people, that really does not seem to be the case. And it doesn't sound like it's at all the case with you. Explain kind of the lasting power that the Disney experience has on a lot of people. And I think that's a good segue into this beautiful book.
Well, I would compare it to, in Peter Pan, when they leave London and go to Neverland, and it's just, you know, this beautiful, idyllic place with some pirates, but it's a place that you can just revisit and sort of leave the world behind and enter a world that's perfectly made and perfectly displayed and fully entertaining and colorful, and then it's both always the same and yet always different.
I guess that's the part that sometimes people who are really not Disney people, so to speak, maybe don't kind of appreciate, or that sense of sameness is all that they maybe understand or all that they notice, and maybe not fully appreciating all of the ways in which Disney perpetually remakes itself, reshapes itself over the years. And I'm sure as someone who's been such a frequent visitor to various theme parks, you've seen that up close.
Well, yeah, and to tie it to the book, we talked to about a dozen different people in the Imagineering department, and the Imagineering division of Disney are the people who think up everything that goes into the theme parks, from the decorations that you see on the street to the very elaborate rides that they come up with that everybody loves. And they are, you know, they're constantly at work and constantly creating new things. One of the things that's a big part of the book is the creation of Galaxy's Edge, the new immersive Star Wars land that's at Disneyland and Walt Disney World. So, yeah, they're at work all the time creating new experiences.
Not sitting on their laurels at all. So let's talk more specifically about this book and what an ambitious project it was. First of all, whose idea was it, this idea of following, in a sense, the worldwide world of Disney through the course of a single day? Whose idea or concept was that?
Well, it actually goes to Bob Iger, who was the CEO of the company. I mean, as part of his job as CEO, he goes all over the world and meets all of these people who work for Disney in all these different capacities. And he thought it would be really interesting to show people who love Disney all of the different jobs that go into the creation of, well, what we call the magic of Disney.
And, of course, not just, for instance, Disney World, which is maybe what most Americans know most intimately, but Disney as it is experienced across the globe. So, for instance, when we open up the book, where are we first?
Well, the first stop is actually Walt Disney World with a young woman named Stephanie Carroll, who is a ranch hand. But one of the interesting things about the jobs in this book is Disney takes ordinary jobs like ranch hand and makes them sort of magical and wonderful. And although her main job is to take care of the horses and to guide people on trail rides, she also gets to dress up in the magical coachman outfit from Cinderella and drive the Cinderella coach with a team of 6 white horses that are used for what they call fairy tale weddings. You can hire out the Cinderella coach as part of your wedding for wedding photos and for a wedding experience. And also the Cinderella coach, of course, appears in the parades at Walt Disney World. So not only is Stephanie Carroll taking care of horses, which she's been doing since she was 8 years old, she also gets to be a character in this story.
Hmm. And so Disney takes care to make sure that people that might even have what at a glance would seem like a rather mundane sort of position or responsibility, they see to it that even those kind of jobs have a little bit of magic sprinkled into them, so to speak.
Well, sure. I mean, take, for example, the security guard there's 2 security guards in the book. One of them is at the Disney Studios, and of course, you would think security guard would be a sort of a boring job, but he's the guy who, you know, gets to talk to Chris Pratt and Keanu Reeves and all these people that come in and out of the Disney Studios. The other security guard is at Walt Disney World, a guy named Pete DeFore, who is another Army veteran. There's several in the book, and Pete gets to run what they call the flag retreat ceremony every day at 4:30 when they take the American flag down at the plaza at the end of Main Street USA and retire it for the day. And every day they pick out of the guests who are coming into the park, just randomly select somebody who was a veteran, a United States veteran, and have that veteran participate in the flag retreat ceremony. And they honor that veteran's service every day, a different veteran. So even these really jobs that you would think would be uninteresting have really interesting elements to them.
Lovely. We're speaking with Bruce C. Steele about the book that he helped put together titled One Day at Disney, Meet the People Who Make the Magic Across the Globe. I do want to make sure we spread our gaze on sort of an international level, but I do want to have you explain to our listeners how much of the United States we see in this book. I mean, a lot of people, of course, know all about Disney World, and a lot of people know about Disneyland, which came before it, that are sort of on each of the coasts. But you don't settle for just those 2 locations. Explain to our listeners some of the other places right here in the United States that you also take us to in this book.
Well, of course, Lucasfilm, that creates all the Star Wars movies and experiences, is located in the Bay Area, as is Pixar up around San Francisco. So we spend a lot of time in the San Francisco area. ESPN is headquartered in Bristol, Connecticut. So we also have to go to Bristol, Connecticut. Have to go to New York City to talk to Robin Roberts from Good Morning America and David Muir from ABC World News Tonight. And, of course, then we go to the theme parks in Orlando and Anaheim. Now, I'm probably leaving some out, but that's a good sample.
So that reminds us, of course, that Disney is not just the things that are emblazoned with those Mickey Mouse ears or whatever other logos we associate with Walt Disney himself and Disney itself, but also some of the properties that Disney owns and operates, and that's a considerable list.
It is a considerable list. It's Pixar and Lucasfilm and ESPN and ABC and Adventures by Disney and Broadway shows. There's a lot going on.
So take us beyond the borders of the United States, because, of course, that's part of what is really wonderful about this book. We don't even have time, of course, to go through the entire list, but tell us some of the places outside of the United States that your book takes us.
Well, of course, we have to go to the Shanghai Disneyland Resort and Hong Kong Disneyland and Disneyland in Tokyo. My favorite story about the Asian properties is it was very difficult for me to set up interviews with the folks in Asia, because when they're going to bed, it's about the time we're getting up in the morning.
Right.
So I finally had to get up really early in the morning to talk to a woman who is a stage manager for the parades at Tokyo Disneyland. And I talked to her at 7 o'clock my time in Asheville, North Carolina. And about 15 minutes into the interview, there was some this noise on the line, like, and I couldn't figure out what it was. And they said, oh, the fireworks have just started here. So 7:15 in the morning on the East Coast in Japan, they're wrapping up the day with the fireworks at Disneyland Tokyo. And I just thought that was an amazing example of the scope of Disney and how there's always something going on 24 hours a day somewhere in the world.
Right. One of the things that Disney fans will especially appreciate is that you take us behind some of those cast members only doors where a lot of the magic is actually created away from the public eye. What kind of access were you given, and what did you think about in terms of what would be most interesting to share with the public? And maybe some of those decisions weren't even entirely yours to make.
No, the cast members were indeed selected before I came on board the project. That was a process that took more than a year, and I came on for the last year of the project to do the interviews and the writing. My favorite behind the cast members visit for myself was I was in Walt Disney World, and I got to go to what is called the Holiday Services Warehouse, and it is exactly what it sounds like. It is a huge warehouse. It is bigger than any Costco you can imagine. And there is nothing in there except holiday decorations, 50-foot trees, tiny little trinkets, entire rows of nothing but Santa heads and reindeer and all this stuff. And then in the back of the warehouse is an area that looks like an auto service kind of facility, except instead of servicing autos, they're servicing holiday decorations. So in place of an automobile brought up on a lift, they've got garland hanging there in front of them, and they're fixing up the garland for the holidays. And these people work at this 365 days a year, and you wouldn't even think of it unless you're reading something like One Day at Disney.
Sometimes when we examine things that kind of have an aura of magic about it, sometimes when we examine things more closely, the magic begins to dissipate a little bit. I get the sense from the way you're talking that this has not had that effect at all on you. If anything, you appreciate the magic of Disney even more deeply now.
I think figuring out how the magic works just makes it more magical, because there is all this work and energy and planning and scheming and testing. I can't tell you how many times they have to test out the rides that they put together for the theme parks before they even get to the part where they're building it. And then there's a magical leap in between the technology and the nuts and bolts and the actual experience that is just sort of inexplicable. And I think knowing everything that goes on before you get to the experience just makes that experience all the more fascinating.
Bruce Steele, the book is One Day at Disney: Meet the People Who Make the Magic Across the Globe. Thank you so much. Best wishes.
Thank you.
And I feel very privileged to be able to spend the next few minutes of WGTD's morning show with Susan Goldberg, who is editorial director of National Geographic Partners, editor-in-chief of National Geographic, the first female editor, I might add, of the magazine, which released its very first issue back in the fall of 1888. And certainly National Geographic has a very proud and distinctive legacy. And it is always great to be able to catch up with the good folks at National Geographic to talk about their most recent projects. Susan Goldberg, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you so much, Craig. It's great to be here.
In a moment, we'll talk about the specific project which has you so excited, titled Women, the National Geographic Image Collection. But first, I wonder if I could ask you a more overarching question about National Geographic and its proud history, and in particular, what you see as maybe the most crucial role that National Geographic plays right now in our country and in our world.
Well, thank you for that. As you mentioned, we are 131 years old, and we've been bringing people the world and taking people, you know, out of their own communities and showing them the world for that entire time. I think what we can add to the conversation right now is, you know, we have been covering the natural world during this time. There's so much that is important in terms of what's going on with the environment and, you know, sustaining the planet and making the world a better place. I think we can credibly tell those stories and tell them in a way that will draw people to them rather than having them, you know, run screaming from the room every time you mention climate change.
Right. You are the 10th editor of National Geographic magazine, and you are the first female editor of the magazine. What does that mean to you?
Well, I mean, you know, it was certainly about time, I would say, that National Geographic had a female editor. I've been in the job for about 6 years now. You know, I have been the first woman editor at a number of publications. So what I always say is that it's going to be a lot better. We're going to live in a more equitable society when there aren't so many female firsts anymore, and we're having women in charge is just the normal course of doing business. You know, obviously, I am honored and humbled to hold this role, but I do think that just having women, you know, be the people selected to do the job shouldn't be such a unique occurrence.
Right. It would be nice someday if that news evoked a yawn rather than
exactly.
Cheers. Absolutely.
Exactly.
It would be nice when that became the ordinary course of events, and certainly that is becoming the case slowly but surely. Boy, at any rate, congratulations on that on holding that mantle for this important magazine. So actually, National Geographic is focusing on women in a lot of different ways over the course of the next year. So tell us, first of all, what kind of discussions behind the scenes went on that helped sort of ultimately create this undertaking?
Well, we are on the cusp of it being the 100th anniversary of women getting the right to vote in the United States. The 100th anniversary will be next year in 2020. And it really got us to thinking that it was a great time to reflect on the progress and the changes that women all over the world have seen during this period. I mean, we published our first picture in which the woman is a subject of the photo in National Geographic magazine in 1896. And, of course, you can start there and just see the amazing empowerment of women that's gone on since that time. So we decided to take this moment not only to do a book called using our archives, our image collection, to tell this story with 450 photos of women all over the world, but we also did the first issue of National Geographic magazine in November that is entirely written, photographed, and illustrated by women. So we've really got two things going on, and we're going to have an entire year of coverage looking at the state of women all over the world.
Right. So that issue of National Geographic magazine, I'm seeing the cover before me, called Women, A Century of Change. And I'm very, very excited to see that, and certainly very excited to see the beautiful book, which has just been published, which you were touching on, called Women, the National Geographic Image Collection. Surely with the massive archives of National Geographic, it had to be actually quite a daunting task to search those archives and then to make what I'm sure were some difficult choices about what images to include in this new book. Tell us about that process.
Oh, it was incredibly tough, and maybe even harder than you know. We have 64 million digital and print images in our archive. And so we had our director of photography and other photo editors just start looking at, you know, how to cull that down to tell the story. And as I said, we have about 450 images in the book spread out over 512 pages. It's a big book. It weighs 6 pounds. We got it down to about 700 pages, and we knew that was still way too big. And so, you know, then the really hard work began, just, you know, trying to, you know, there are just so many wonderful images, as you can imagine. You know, we are known for our photography. We always have been. So just culling it down, it was a fight over every single photo. But I do think that we really ended up in a terrific place. I love the kind of narrative arc that you see through these photos, how women start out really as decorative objects or just shown in traditional roles, and then ending up doing every kind of work, getting educated, female warriors. I mean, you name it, you see women playing the roles.
Actually, I think that's yet another challenge that you surely faced, is the fact that, in a sense, what it means to be a woman and what, in sort of a sense, the day-to-day existence of women varies so wildly depending on where you live, and whether it's a place of privilege in a country like the United States versus some other part of the world where women face all kinds of degradation and disrespect of every kind, or at least what looks like disrespect through our perspective, and what might be a different kind of normal in a different kind of culture. How did you grapple with that reality, the fact that the story of women is a story that varies so wildly depending on where you are on the planet?
I'm really glad you brought that up, because this is one of the most important things that I think people can take away from this book. You know, we are privileged in this country and in many other countries to see the great progress that women have made, and that clearly comes through in the photographs. But one of the things we wanted to do in this book is to shine the light into every corner of the world where women really don't have the same rights necessarily that we do here, where women are, you know, not protected from violence, where they don't have the same respect. And I think it's important to really look at that, so we can, you know, the way to fix a problem is to shine a light on it. And I believe that as a journalist, and have believed that for my entire career. And I think that is what people can take away from this book, that it is an inspiring book when you see the progress, but it's also sobering, because you do need to look at the places where there still is so much inequality and inequity.
One thing I don't think we've yet mentioned is that this book is not only a magnificent collection of highlights from the extensive photographic legacy of the National Geographic stretching over 130 years, but also it includes some input, some commentary from some very important contemporary women. Explain to our listeners some of the important women that you were privileged to speak with and whose testimony is part of this book.
Yes, thank you. I was so privileged to talk to 24 just amazing women, everybody from Oprah Winfrey to Jane Goodall to Melinda Gates to Nancy Pelosi, you know, and many more in between, just breakthrough scientists and educators, just wonderful women. And I really talked to them about two things. One was about their own journey, and then the other was about what they thought was the state of women in the world and what needed to change to have women be on an equal playing field. And I thought that their answers were, you know, funny, interesting, insightful, sometimes sobering. They were just as interesting as you might imagine. So it was a great privilege to be able to talk to all these women.
As I looked at the list of the women that you spoke to, I was really struck that there was such a wide swath of perspective represented. That, for instance, we have somebody like former First Lady Laura Bush, and we have someone like the young woman Emma Gonzalez, who is one of our country's most potent activists on behalf of the issue of gun control. I mean, I suspect that you thought long and hard and were really, really careful to make sure that this list of women to whom you spoke would represent a wide array of experience and perspective.
Well, that's exactly right. Just as the photos themselves show, just in the amazing different faces of womanhood in the world, we wanted to have a real diversity of voices for the contemporary women that we talked to. We wanted to make sure it wasn't just one political perspective or one kind of career or one race or ethnicity. So we went all over the world and all over the map, really, when it came to the kinds of women we talked to. Because as you said, there is not one way of being a woman. There is not one perspective. It is why you see a collage of photographs, both on the cover of the magazine as well as on the cover of the book, because we knew that not one picture could sum up what it means to be a woman.
A last question. We've already mentioned the fact that this next issue of National Geographic magazine is titled Women, A Century of Change, but this is not just a one-month celebration, but it will go on from there. Can you just give us at least a hint of what readers to National Geographic magazine can look forward to in the coming months around this topic of women?
Oh, absolutely. We are going to look at the roles that women are playing over the next year in democracies around the world, places from Bolivia to, you know, to Nepal. We're going to look at the unique role that beauty has in the lives of women and how that is interpreted culturally differently in different places of the world. We're going to look at women as mothers and the subject of motherhood. We're going to talk about that through the stories of lullabies that women tell. So we're going to look at just a huge range of issues. One of the stories I'm very proud of in the November issue is the story about women warriors. We looked at women who are in the armies and militaries and navies all over the planet, and it is just such an inspiring story of, you know, what women can do.
Mm-hmm. The book, again, is Women, the National Geographic Image Collection, and it is a beautiful book and massive. And the November issue of National Geographic magazine is called Women, A Century of Change, and more information is available at nationalgeographic.com. Susan Goldberg, Editorial Director of National Geographic Partners, Editor-in-Chief of National Geographic magazine, thank you so much, and thank you for the good work of National Geographic.
Thank you so much, Greg. I appreciate it.
And for this portion of the morning show, I'm excited to be able to speak with Lauren Paley, who is on the staff at DK Publishing. And DK is responsible for all kinds of marvelous books, including, I must say, the series of travel guides that have been indispensable to my wife and I in various trips that we have made. And we have on our shelf DK travel guides to Venice and Paris and several to New York City and to Washington, D.C. and other places. And in a lot of ways, they are just put together better than any other travel guides we have ever found. But we're not talking about that today as much as we're going to be talking about some wonderful new books that have just been published by DK that perhaps would make sense to be on someone's gift-giving list for these coming holidays. And so Lauren Paley is here. She is Associate Marketing Manager for Travel at DK, and so she works in particular with many of the travel guides that they are responsible for. Lauren Paley, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you so much, and thank you for your support of the travel guides. And I do want to mention that travel guides are actually a great gift. I know that we're not showcasing them necessarily today, but if you know that somebody's going on a trip in the next few weeks or the next year, buying them a travel guide is a really great way to personalize that holiday time. So just a quick little note on that.
Right. And let me just reiterate that, I mean, there are a lot of things that I love about those DK travel guides, but one of them is that when you take, for instance, a major city like New York City or Paris, one of the things that these guides does is that it breaks up the city into various neighborhoods. And so it isn't a big, long chapter about restaurants scattered all over New York City and then a big, long chapter about museums scattered all over New York City, but rather here's Soho and here's Greenwich Village and here's Harlem. And within each of those neighborhoods, you can read all about all kinds of interesting things. And I just think that makes all the sense in the world. And I've never seen other travel guides that are set up in that way. And it's absolutely terrific.
Absolutely. I completely agree.
Let's talk now, though, about some of these wonderful books from DK that have just been published that are really, really wonderful books. And what I was really struck by the three that I was sent, one called Bake It, one called Where to Go When, that I know you'll be anxious to talk about, and another called The Wonders of Nature, is that these struck me as books that would be of great interest and would be enjoyed by a wide range of readers, including young people. And I wonder to what extent that is a real conscious decision to make these books of such wide-ranging appeal.
Absolutely. So let's start with Bake It. That's one of my favorite books that we're featuring here today. So that's actually geared towards preteen bakers who are interested in learning more about baking, honing their skills. And I think it's wonderful because it's so bright, it's so fun, and it has over 100 sweet and savory recipes that have not only the recipes step-by-step, but it also has images of what it's supposed to look like each step of the way. So I think it's great not only for preteens, but as you said, it kind of can span outwards for adults. I know that I am not the best baker, and I find this book to be really, really fun and inspirational to flip through. And I think that The Wonders of Nature, absolutely, it is actually geared towards kids, ages about 7 to 9, but it's one of those books that really anyone in the family can enjoy because it is so pretty. It has this beautiful cloth-like cover, these gold foil embellishments, and then on the inside, it covers everything in nature from plants to animals and microorganisms, and it combines this beautiful photography with these really beautiful hand-drawn images. So I think that it's really great that it's so beautiful that everyone can really enjoy it.
Absolutely. I suspect that the book that is nearest and dearest to your heart is the one called Where to Go When, subtitled Unforgettable Trips for Every Month. And this is a really fascinating book that I have absolutely loved exploring. Explain to our listeners, in a sense, how this is set up.
Yeah, so I think you hit the nail on the head. This is absolutely my favorite book, probably of all time, that DK has made. So it has over 100 of the world's best destinations, and then it showcases when you should visit them month by month. So for each month, it has about 8 to 12 destinations that it highlights, and it shows you why you should go during this specific time period because of weather or festivals or whatever else is going on in the country. And it's accompanied by photography that just is absolutely gorgeous. It makes you want to book a plane ticket immediately.
Right. So, for instance, if we open it up to the month of January, we are treated to 10 different places that one might enjoy visiting in the month of January. And they range from Jamaica to Norway. But the very first place is a place I've thought about visiting because a colleague of mine is from there, St. Petersburg, Russia. And of course, and each chapter begins with the simple section, why go? and I suppose that's really important to kind of make the case right off the bat about why it makes sense to travel all the way to St. Petersburg, Russia, and in the month of January.
Yeah, and I think that those blurbs really give you a great idea of what the editors and writers are trying to do to explain exactly what you said, why you should go at this specific time. And then I think that the photographs that are accompanying the text do such a good job of just drawing you in and making you think to yourself, maybe St. Petersburg is worth it in January. And I think it's great because it might shift your perspective on when you think might be a good time to go to a specific destination.
Right. And what I appreciate, too, is that this book obviously strays beyond kind of the customary vacation spots that we might immediately think of. I mean, we are learning about places that are in the heart of Ethiopia, or in the heart of Wyoming, or a small community in the very northern province of Norway. Tell us how this book got put together in terms of all of these destinations and sort of the process by which this book took shape.
Yeah, so basically the way that the book was put together is that our amazing editors in the UK work with experts, travel experts from around the world to write these little snippets, and they curate this beautiful, gorgeous book that you can go purchase today. And the way that they picked all of the destinations was kind of a combination of things. I think they wanted to showcase both well-known destinations like New York City and London, but also showcase places that, like you said, you might have never heard of. And I think that they do a really good job of that. And they were also very conscious of what they put in terms of over-tourism. For example, in the Peru Machu Picchu text, they chose not to highlight the Inca Trail and instead chose to highlight another trail because of over-tourism on the Inca Trail. So I think that they were definitely thinking about balancing all of those things, being eco-friendly, thinking about the best places to inspire, all of those things kind of working together.
Very, very, very much so. I appreciate, too, that although I don't think this book was written with, you know, for instance, a 10-year-old reader in mind, on the other hand, it is a book that is really written at a level where I think kind of just about whoever you are, you're going to find something to take away from it.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, even if you just put it out on your coffee table, it's going to look beautiful. A 6-year-old can flip through and enjoy the beautiful pictures. A 30-year-old can get inspired about their next trip. A couple can plan their honeymoon destination. It can really be whatever you want it to be for that inspiration.
Again, the book is titled Where to Go When, Unforgettable Trips for Every Month. And let's talk for a moment about this beautiful book called The Wonders of Nature, which is really incredible as well. And one of the things that I find especially intriguing about this book is that this is not just a book full of beautiful flowers and butterflies and whatever, but it actually starts with rocks. And in fact, there's quite an extensive section of the book that is all about rocks and minerals. And what a great idea. I mean, because this is indeed part of the beautiful natural world around us, but it's not necessarily something we would expect to find in a book like this.
Absolutely, yeah. I think that this book does such a great job of pulling out information that would inspire and spark curiosity in both children and, honestly, adults as well. And I love how on each page it gives a little bit of context about the rock or the mineral or the animal that they are highlighting, and it has that beautiful photography, it has that beautiful image, but then it also pulls out a fun fact that can draw in the kid. And I think that that does a really great job of kind of showcasing why is this interesting? Why should you care about this? So it goes beyond just presenting the information. It does more to spark curiosity.
Right. And I like that beyond rocks and minerals, the next section of the book is devoted to microscopic life. And this is also the kind of thing that wouldn't necessarily be included in something like this, but it's some of the most beautiful pages in this book, some of what we find in this section.
Absolutely. I know I learned a lot in that section in particular. I said, I didn't even know this existed. What is this? This is incredible. And I think that kids will definitely have the same reaction.
Right. For instance, one of the spreads in this section is devoted to something called star sand. And we would sometimes, you know, see this and think it's sand, and in fact it is the empty shells of miniature creatures. And these tiny little exoskeletons look a little bit like stars, tiny, tiny, tiny stars. And I had no idea that this existed until I picked up this book. And, of course, beyond there we go on to the animal kingdom and the plant kingdom, and we come away with a new appreciation for all the beauty that surrounds us. Let's finish out by returning to the book Bake It, which features 150 favorite recipes from Best Love DK cookbooks. So this is actually building on other things that have already been published. But as you said, this is really put together to be of help to a lot of people, including even children who are interested in learning how to do things in the kitchen a little bit better.
Absolutely. So Bake It is such a fun book. It is so colorful. It really catches your eye from the start. It has these colorful cupcakes on the cover. And I think when you open up Bake It, it's really accessible. So it starts with introductory information about baking. It starts with the techniques and the terminology, and then it transitions into all of these different recipes. And someone who's not very comfortable with baking can start with a more simple recipe, and they kind of showcase the level of difficulty by giving different cupcake signs. One cupcake means it's a pretty simple recipe, and then all the way up to four cupcakes means it's definitely more challenging. It's more of a sophisticated recipe. So I really like that they have that range to appeal to all sorts of bakers.
Right. And we have everything here from the pizza to butter cookies to quiche to apple crumble to various pastries and wonderful decadent cakes and all kinds of things. As you said, early on in the book, we are treated to a nice exploration of a lot of basics. And as you, I think, correctly pointed out, a lot of these are basics that a lot of us either need to learn finally or need to be reminded about.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, we want to say then that these three books that come from DK are Bake It, The Wonders of Nature, and Where to Go When, Unforgettable Trips for Every Month. Again, all from DK Publishing. And I want to express my appreciation to you, Lauren, for joining us today on The Morning Show. Best wishes to you and everybody at DK Publishing.
Thank you so much. You as well.
Bye-bye. Good morning. We are speaking for the next few minutes with one of the editors of Mental Floss, the book, The Greatest Lists in the History of Listery. And Ethan Trex is one of the editors of this really fun paperback from HarperCollins, which represents a full decade of what has been around on this website known as Mental Floss. Ethan Trex, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Good morning, Greg. How are you?
I'm just fine. So tell us how somebody gets a gig like this. I mean, dealing in the wonderful world of listery.
Oh, you gotta read a lot and get really good at writing down numbers and then writing paragraphs after them. We are all huge trivia buffs and just love going out and finding the weirdest, most fun, most informative stories we possibly can and bring them to our readers.
And how do you go about doing that? I mean, on kind of a typical search and secure sort of mission, what kinds of places do you go looking for this kind of offbeat information?
There is nothing more amazing than Google's newspaper archives that you can just go through, because you'll be looking for one thing and you'll find some paper from 1973 and you'll think, all right, well, this isn't exactly what I needed, but the adjacent story will be something insane. So you can just sort of thumb through old sources, and then you start finding more and more fascinating stuff. If you read anything long enough, you're going to find a really good story.
So compare this book, Mental Floss, the book, to the actual website, which in a sense has spawned it. Is this sort of a greatest hits collection, a fairly representative sort of sampling, kind of a random sampling? What is the relationship between the website and this really fascinating, fun book?
Well, we have a website, and we actually started as a magazine. We still have our bi-monthly magazine that's sort of our flagship. So after 10 years of doing both the website and the magazine, we had just a huge archive of these great lists, and we kind of wanted to pull the best of them out and get those back out there to people so they could see, you know, if we wrote something that we really loved 7 years ago, people probably haven't seen it since, so we wanted to pull it out of the archives and let people see what our best stuff was.
Can you say a word about this great title, Mental Floss? Do you know anything about who exactly came up with that? Were you part of that decision?
No, I was not. Our magazine was founded at Duke University in 2001. It was founded in a dorm room by two students, and they came up with the name, and it's catchy. People remember it. It's great. but I don't know exactly how they did come up with it.
It is a great name. It, in a sense, is really fitting. It seems like a very nice, easy, entertaining mental workout. I mean, you've done yourself some good when you've done some reading through Mental Floss.
That's what we like to say. That if you read it, you'll pick it up, you'll be entertained. There's a lot of jokes in it. It's fun, and you'll learn a lot, but you won't feel like you're reading something dry and scholarly. You'll be smarter without knowing it.
Very good. So I have a couple of favorites that I'm going to ask you about, if you like, and then I'll give you a chance to highlight a couple of your favorite lists that are part of this. I thought in the first chapter called Cheat Sheets for Impressing a Diplomat, President, or Pope, I actually found myself rather rapidly skimming past the stuff related to politics and found myself instead most interested in five secrets of the Vatican being exposed. I learned some things here that I absolutely never heard of before.
What was that?
Well, for one thing, that there's a high crime rate at the Vatican. I mean, the highest crime rate in the world. Never knew that till I read Mental Floss.
Right. I mean, that's almost a math thing, because not that many people live there, but lots of people go to the Vatican as tourists or go there to go to mass. So it's pickpocket central, apparently.
Evidently.
Like 1.5 crimes each year per citizen of the Vatican, which is insane.
Hmm. A lot of the lists here are kind of crazy off-the-wall lists, but some of them really contain really good, solid, equally fascinating information. For instance, I really like the last list in the second chapter, lists that should come with a lab coat, which are all lists related to scientific matters of one kind or another. And the final list in that chapter is Five Ways Museums Detect Forgeries. It's the kind of thing we know somebody knows a lot about, but typically it isn't us who knows very much about how that's done.
Oh, that stuff is fascinating. My favorite thing in that list is that when people are trying to verify that an old painting is real, you can look at these little cracks in the paint, and they don't crack randomly, so they crack in very specific ways. And if it's real, it will be cracked one way, and if it's fake, it will be cracked another. It's just so cool to look at.
Absolutely. Never knew that. I also, as someone who is in the middle of his life, been sort of rebitten by the Crayola crayon bug. I enjoyed reading about some of the retired Crayola crayons over the years and the reason why some of their colors have been retired over the years. Fun stuff.
Yeah, Prussian blue used to be a really popular crayon, but then I guess in the late 50s, after Prussia hadn't been a country for a long time, Crayola realized kids didn't know where Prussia was. So they changed it to Midnight Blue, which is a little less exciting.
Right. And, of course, it's interesting to read about how, understandably, Crayola felt compelled at some point, I think you say in the early 60s, to change the Crayola that had been called Flesh to Peach, because, of course, Crayola knew as well as all of the rest of us knew that flesh comes in all kinds of different colors. Lots of interesting information like that in this book. Why don't you tell us a couple of your favorite lists that we should seek out?
Oh, one of my favorite ones is we have a piece on five famous actors and the roles they turned down, because it's just amazing to think about these really famous movies, what they would have been like if they'd gotten their original casting choices. Like in the Lord of the Rings trilogy, they originally wanted Sean Connery to play Gandalf, and New Line Cinema, who was producing the movie, wanted him so badly, they offered him 15% of the worldwide gross on the movie if he would take it, and he still turned it down, and obviously Ian McKellen played the part. If he would have gotten $400 million, it would have been the most lucrative role any actor had ever played.
Incredible. That just kind of makes you stop and shake your head, doesn't it? I mean, we just can't reimagine that.
At that point, you can barely even conceive of how much money that is, so I guess he's probably not kicking himself too hard. I mean, he was James Bond. He still has that going for him.
Right. And, of course, you talk about other celebrities, about famous books and what they were almost called, fun little things about children and babies, all kinds of things found in this fascinating book called Mental Floss, The Book. Only the greatest lists in the history of listry. This is a paperback from HarperCollins. And
I had great fun reading this, Ethan Trex, and look forward to reading it again. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, Doug.